welcome to the final edition of this year's Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host this morning, Barb Bretz. Coming up also, we're going to be speaking with Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean Means, as well as the director from the U.S. documentary film Three Identical Strangers, and then with the documentary premiere Chef Flynn. We'll be back right after this message.
Support for the Sundance Reel on KPCW comes from the film Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee, premiering during the 2018 Sundance Film Festival, a documentary about Sandra Lee's journey through breast cancer from diagnosis to recovery and encouraging early detection for all women.
Well, Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean Means and KPCW Friday film reviewer Barb Bretz joining me now in the studio to tell us what films they loved as part of the Sundance 2018 slate, what films they could have lived without this week, and what you should put on your must-watch list. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Yeah, so let's. I'm going to start first with Barb. Barb, you want to just talk a little bit about just the VR experience this year, virtual reality, also I sometimes now known as augmented reality. I don't know the difference, but
mixture between the two. Well, I was really excited to do this because I got my first taste of it last year in the VR Palace, which was just back here behind the studio. It was a ticketed event, and you basically got your hour time and floated between several different installations and did whatever you could. This year, the VR ticketed events are in the new theater called The Ray. They're downstairs, and they've really done a remarkable job just setting up the structure itself. Is really great. And there are kind of two separate types of experiences there, and both of these are ticketed. You do have to have a ticket or do a wait list, and there was some success yesterday with the bad weather of people not showing up and the wait list getting in. But the two experiences are either in the Box Theater, which is a very small theater, and from what I understand, it's a synchronized VR experience where they load the theater with about 40 people. I'm assuming you have on headphones and eye gear. I'm not exactly sure, but you get to see several different installations that are part of like a short series of things, and I do believe that the creators of those projects, or at least some of them, are there for a Q&A. So I heard a lot of applause coming out of there, and a few people that I talked to as they came out loved the experience. The one that I did was called New Frontier at the Ray, and that was basically what the VR Palace was last year. There are maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 different exhibits or installations. Some of them are 3 or 4 minutes long. One of them 13. I think the longest one was 20. Sometimes they can handle 2 people at a time. There was one called Chorus where 6 people go in and experience it at the same time. But the technology is just so incredible. And I'm not a gamer, so I don't look at it through the eyes of a gamer, but it certainly makes me understand how people can get addicted to that whole video world because it really is amazing.
Wow. So, Sean, is that something you spend any time doing?
I got to do a little of the VR on the press preview last Friday, and I did Chorus, which is, it's very much a game, a game-based setup. There's 6 of you in different sort of cubicles, but in the game, you're all playing together. Your avatars.
You become one of those warriors.
Your avatars are playing each other, and you're shooting ugly little birds and stuff. And you look down at your hands and you can see your hands and see your arms and all that sort of thing. And that one was very cool. What I love about the Box is that it sort of answers one of the complaints about VR, which is it's a solitary experience. You do put on the goggles and you have the headphones on, and so you're isolated from everyone else. But if all 40 of you are doing it together at the same time, then you're sharing, you are still sharing an experience. And the cool part is when it's all over, y'all get to go have coffee and talk about it.
But I don't hear your oohs and ahs and your boos or yays or
yes, yeah. Yes, you do.
Oh, you do.
You kind of tune it out because each experience that you're, you know, the experience that you're immersed in is really so enthralling that it's not that hard to tune it out. Did you do spheres, Sean?
I did not do spheres.
I
heard that one was so so spectacular that it even made Robert Redford buckle at the knees.
I wondered if that's the one that made him fall. He stumbled and popped back up. But you really are. It's very similar to the one we did last year where you're kind of in the universe. And, I mean, you see these incredible, I don't even, experiences. Go the black holes. You just see all this stuff. You have monitor little gizmos in your hand where you can create different patterns in the stars. And at one point they say, use your voice to sing to the universe. And so you do hear people and with just humming or a little just ooh, and it sounds like angels out in the sky. It really was phenomenal.
Yeah, it's bizarre. It always is. I would encourage people to stop by. They do have a couple of installations, I think, that are open to the public at Kimball Arts Center.
At Kimball Arts Center and at the VR Bar. And those are non-ticketed, but you do have to have credentials to get into those.
Okay. Well, let's kick off with talk about films. Sean, your goal, of course, always to make it to all of the films in competition, mm-hmm. 32, 16 of dramatic and competitions. You make it all?
Not on the documentary side, not even close this year. Just the schedule conspired against me. But I'm seeing three of the dramatics today, and that'll round out the set of 16 in the U.S. dramatic competition. And then I've got two more documentaries, which will give me 11 of the 16 there. But yeah, things conspire. I mean, doing things like spending 3 hours standing in line waiting to get in to see Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the Cinema Cafe, stuff like that. You know,
was it worth it?
Entirely, yes. It was. You know, freezing my toes off and all that. But it was to be in the room with her talking with Nina Totenberg about herself and her life. Yeah, that's one I'm going to tell my grandkids about someday. So that's, you know, it was definitely worth it. And then seeing RBG later that day and again, seeing her in the room was entirely wonderful. So
so have you seen anything else outside of that competition?
Oh, yeah, quite a few of the documentary premieres, including RBG. The other documentary premiere that I really enjoyed, and it was quite an event, especially obviously here in Utah, was Believer, which is the documentary about Dan Reynolds, the frontman for Imagine Dragons, and how he's trying to reconcile his strong Mormon faith with his strong support of LGBT teens, many of which listen to Imagine Dragons albums. And how he is trying to, through his, you know, power of rock stardom, start a conversation, start a dialogue with the LDS Church to change their policies regarding the LGBT community. And how he and Tyler Glenn of Neon Trees, who they came up together in the Provo club scene.
A club scene in Provo?
There's quite a club scene in Provo. Among other things, it gave us Neon Trees and Imagine Dragons.
That's amazing.
They're friends. And Tyler grew up Mormon. Funny enough, they both went. Both Dan Reynolds and Tyler Glenn served a mission in Omaha. not quite at the same time, but they were both at the Omaha mission, which is just a funny coincidence. Tyler came out about 4 years ago. He's gay,
But Dan is not, correct?
Dan's married, has three little girls. He's very Mormon. He's very, you know, he very much believes in the LDS faith. If you recall, there was a concert in August in Orem called the Love Loud Festival, which Dan and Tyler put together. Both of their bands played, and the idea was to get support and solidarity with the LGBT community. So, and this movie is about that and about Dan's spiritual journey and trying to figure it all out.
Have they had pushback or negative reaction from the church?
The church ultimately endorsed the event, which helped ticket sales immensely because a lot of people were sort of on the fence about it. Tyler called that a PR stunt, but, you know, whatever works. And Dan has said that they're going to continue the Love Loud Festival once a year until they don't need it anymore, is basically what they've said. Anyway, this movie is very heartfelt, and Reynolds has very definitely got his heart in the right place. And I'll tell you one thing it did for me is that it made me an Imagine Dragons fan.
They do have a song called Believer,
they
right?
The title of the movie comes from one of Reynolds' songs. That was one of my more favorite movies. Hmm. Another one outside of the competition that I really liked, I saw last night, was the surprise add-on, Tully. This is coming out in April. It is Jason Reitman directing and Diablo Cody screenwriter. And they're the pair that gave us Juno and Young Adult. And so this is their third collaboration. And this again has Charlize Theron as a woman who has just given birth to her third child and is frazzled beyond belief. And her wealthy brother suggests and offers to pay for a night nanny who will help sort of smooth over things in the first few months. And so this young woman named Tully enters her life, and things happen.
The nanny story?
No, it's not the nanny story.
No.
I don't get the wrong idea.
No.
There.
She makes a joke about how, you know, the one of the things about nannies is you're going to wind up, you know, having to kill each other or having to try to kill her at the end of a Lifetime movie type of thing. You know?
But I thought there was some really funny groundwork, and this will make sense later on. I don't want to spoil anything. But somebody says, you know, how could the husband not know this, or how could the husband not know that? And at one point, the first night the nanny shows up, Charlize comes up to the bedroom, and she says, you know, she's really kind of weird, and, you know, da-da-da-da. And the dad says, and you're going to leave our kid with her? She goes, I guess so. She's just so tired, she wants to go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine so. So let's talk about some of the competition films, though.
Okay.
Let's start with the documentaries. I mean, what's just, again, something we should look for?
The one that struck me the most, and the one I've enjoyed the most, was Minding the Gap.
I've heard that, Sean. I didn't see that.
Bing Liu, a young filmmaker, I think has got a lot of promise. This is his story, personal story about him and his former skateboarding buddies. When they were younger, they all used to hang out at the skate park together.
Can we assume this is set in London or no?
No, this is in Rockford, Illinois, a small town in Illinois. Bing reunites with his two buddies and sort of figures out where they, you know, talks about where they are in their lives right now. And one of them has a baby mama and a baby, and is dealing with all that sort of thing. The other one is 18, just about to finish high school. And as it goes, it turns out to be more than just about three buddies. It turns out to be about the vicious cycle of domestic violence that has affected all three of them, that all three of them came from homes where there was domestic violence, and how they have to fight exceedingly hard not to repeat those same cycles. It is very heartfelt. It is very moving. And something else is that this guy can shoot skateboard footage better than anybody I've ever seen. Edits like a dream. So it is also a very compelling, very visually fascinating movie. So.
Okay. What other standouts?
Let me look at my list here. In the
documentary. Mm-hmm.
Hal. I am not as up on my Hal Ashby as I would like to be.
But I'm going to be. This is going to motivate me to do a Hal Ashby film festival.
I take a week off after the festival. I'm going to be binging a lot of Hal Ashby movies. This is a great documentary about the guy who directed such movies as Harold and Maude, Shampoo, Being There, Coming Home.
Last Detail,
you know, and not necessarily in that order, but it is fascinating about how he has become one of the most sort of influential filmmakers, even amongst other filmmakers, because there's a fair list of people who are interviewed in this movie, like Alexander Payne and David O. Russell and Adam McKay and Judd Apatow. who talk about how Hal Ashby inspired them in various ways in their films. But it also talks about how he was one of these, you know, 70s giants alongside like Scorsese and Coppola and Spielberg and so on, but that he was such a maverick and so unwilling to play ball with the suits that he basically, his career tanked by the 80s.
So the film you liked just because of Hal being in it? I mean, was he the...
It was a great combination of biographical and film analysis. That I mean, for movie people, for people who love movies, and I think we have a few of them here this week. It's just like catnip, really.
Yeah, and let's add a third one then.
Let's add a third one. One I saw last night, and there's actually a bunch of these up together. Two profiles of activists dealing with international problems. One is Kailash, which is about the child slavery crusader in India who won the Nobel Peace Prize. He actually shared the Nobel Peace Prize with Malala. A couple of years ago, and it's very, very exciting thriller, almost a thriller, because it shows how they sort of go into these factories where child labor, you know, is being, you know, forced child labor is happening, and by the way, with labels for stores that you might shop in America. So keep an eye out for that. And then the other is On Her Shoulders, which is about Nadia Murad, who was a Yazidi in northern Iraq. Survivor of genocide, survival of sex slavery, who has become an international activist to fight against sex trafficking and other issues. And this one is really beautiful because it shows how the combination of her determination to fight, you know, continue this fight, at the same time dealing with sort of a survivor's guilt, the idea that she survived and many of her compatriots did not, and also just the notion of her trying to go on and have a normal life.
Okay, we're going to take a quick underwriting break. We'll be back talking a little bit more with Sean Means from the Salt Lake Tribune and Barb Bretz here on the Sundance Reel. This is KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from the Wasatch Brew Pub, offering weekend brunch at the top of Main Street, featuring traditional favorites as well as midday Marys and mimosas. Private event space available. Wasatch Brew Pub. We drink our share and sell the rest. WasatchBeers.com.
Hey, have you been to the Swanner Eco Center? Do you know they have a climbing wall?
I love the Saturday morning snowshoe tours and learning about the wetlands. The exhibits are cool too.
Do you know you can go to the top of the observation tower to look for wildlife?
Connect to nature at Swanner Eco Center, located in the New Park Town Center.
Visit SwannerEcoCenter.org for more information. Thanks to all our supporters. Swanner is a nonprofit organization and a supporter of KPCW.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
And welcome back to the Sundance Reel. Leslie Thatcher here along with Salt Lake Tribune film critic Sean Means and KPCW Friday film reviewer Barb Bretz. Turning now to the dramatic films in this year's Sundance competition. And Sean, let's take a look at some of the top ones for you this year.
My favorite so far, I've got three to go to fill out the U.S. Dramatics. My favorite is Burden. This is a really strong drama. Stars Garrett Hedlund as it's a true story based on a guy in South Carolina who is a member of the Klan, and how between the love of his girlfriend and the support of a black minister in the town, he managed to leave the Klan, which is something you're not really supposed to do. Once you're in, and fight against the influences of the Ku Klux Klan. Great cast. Forest Whitaker plays the preacher. Andrea Riseborough, who is sort of the queen of Sundance this year. She's in four films, and is different in every one of them. She's this great chameleon of a performer, who you would not know is actually British by seeing some of the movies. And Tom Wilkinson as the patriarch, who is this like rabid, you know, Klansman, really powerful stuff, really moving film.
And is it Usher that's in that one too?
Usher, yeah. Raymond is in there as well, yes. So, it's a strong cast, and it's really well done. Race issues and race relations are like sort of key at some of the more interesting and more quality films in the competition. You have Blindspotting, which was the opening night film, where you have David Diggs and Rafael Casal, who co-star and co-wrote it. And people know David Diggs from his Tony-winning performance in Hamilton. And this is about two buddies in a rapidly gentrifying Oakland, California. You also have Monster, which is a courtroom thriller about a 17-year-old who's accused, who's on trial for what prosecutors say is his role in a killing in a bodega, and then Monsters and Men, which is kind of controversial in some places, in that it tells the story of a police shooting where a policeman has shot an unarmed man, and it's told from three different angles. It's told from the angle of a young father who videotaped the event,
Hispanic, right? Who's
Hispanic,
Puerto
played by Anthony,
Rican, yeah.
played by Anthony Ramos, a young black cop, played by John David Washington, who was the son of Denzel Washington.
Oh, okay.
And then a black teen baseball phenom who lives in the same neighborhood, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who also starred in Monster.
He's another up-and-comer to watch. He is remarkable.
He's very definitely an up-and-comer. Those movies, and then the one I'm seeing later today that is Sorry to Bother You, which is sort of satire, also set in Oakland. And then less successful, there was one called Tyrell, which is about a sort of bunch of dude bros having a weekend party out in a cabin in the woods somewhere, and one guy who's there who's like the one black guy amongst all the white guys. So these issues of race relations and whatnot are all very, very much tied into it. And Monsters and Men, it works really, really well. Blindspotting, it works really well. Tyrell, not so much. And I keep hearing about Sorry to Bother You.
I saw it.
In that it's like bananas, right?
It's quirky, but it's so engaging. It is entertaining. I'm really glad I saw it.
I'm seeing it tonight, I think.
I think you'll enjoy it.
So when you choose films that you like, I mean, is it because you think of the commercial appeal they have, or you just think they've just done a great job as filmmakers?
Well, one of the reasons I like to see all 16 of the dramatic competition is I like to get that spectrum. I like to get the more commercial projects, but I also like to get the offbeat, unusual, more very arty sort of things. It's also why I like to delve into the next program and some of the others, just to sort of see what's out there, and it's also why I tend to avoid the premieres, largely because most of those are going to have big stars, and they're going to be, if they don't already have distribution, they will get it quickly enough, and I'll see them when they come out in general commercial release. So
yeah, did you get to see We the Animals? That was something I saw yesterday as part of the next program.
I did not. Okay. I did not see that one.
Now to me, that was such an interesting film. Hard to watch at times, but yeah. Mm-hmm. And then what about Foxtrot? That was in the spotlight.
Yes, that was Israel's entry for the Oscars. Did not make the it was in the shortlist, but it did not make the final five. That's actually coming out theatrically in Salt Lake sometime in March or April, I believe.
And that's one that the clip is very misleading.
Yes,
you guys
it is.
And Trevor did say when you showed it at the preview night, mm-hmm. Don't get the feeling from this clip that this is all, because the clip is adorable. It's really fun and lighthearted, but the movie is very, very powerful and
right.
Very well done.
It starts out very serious and then gets very absurdist. And when the
container starts to shift.
and things, and it does get, it does, you know, it's a very jarring transition, but it sort of makes the point about the absurdity of combat and of war. So
yeah. So what do you do? I mean, after this 10 days, you told me you're going to take a week off, but do you spend time then just trying to write reviews at this point, or?
We're not concentrating so much on reviews this year, trying to concentrate more on the experience of the festival. And so I did a lot of stories about, you know, covering events like Dan Reynolds movie, like the Respect Rally last Saturday, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's visit, and also things like, you know, I had a column that's in the paper today about the 9 types of people you meet at a Q&A.
That was hilarious. You know, I did catch that.
Things like that. Trying to distill what it's like just being here during the 10 days. And but also to remind people that, yes, you know, for all the stuff about the celebrity spotting and the people taking selfies down on Main Street and whatnot, that this is a film festival, and the point of the film festival is to watch films.
And I always wondered, Sean, because Redford always stresses in the opening day press conference that the film festival really came after the lab, and the lab was nurturing the filmmaking. Have you ever gone behind the scenes and visited any of the labs pre-stuff?
I've been down to the labs a few times in the summer, and it's very fascinating. It's you get these filmmakers who have their first scripts or their second scripts, and they get to sort of workshop a couple difficult scenes and do so in a place where if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. If it does work, then hey, you've got a DVD extra. You know, they bring in advisors, people who know the business very well, a lot of great filmmakers, actors, cinematographers, so on. And then they also bring in like professional actors to work with and give them get their scenes up on their feet and see what they look like when you can actually, you know, put it together. It's weird to see, you know, an unused winter cabin down at the Sundance Resort being turned into a, you know, tenement house in Brooklyn or something. But, you know, you do what you do.
Yeah. So what's your feel then for this year's festival? I mean, have we seen some real quality stuff in your mind compared to what
I've seen a lot of really good and sometimes even great movies. I have not really seen, you know, there hasn't been anything that's been a complete jumping out of your seat sort of experience the way last year. I mean, last year we had Call Me By Your Name, we had The Big Sick, we had the secret screening of Get Out that some people got to see early, and we had Mudbound. You know, think about that. Mudbound, Get Out, and Call Me By Your Name each got 4 Oscar nominations, and Big Sick got a screenplay nomination. So, you know, we haven't had any movie that really, you know, jumps out in that level. Or the great example I always give is Beasts of the Southern Wild, that came out of nowhere and just became just this amazing thing. Nothing has really done that, but there's been a lot of really good stuff. So
yeah, any guesses as to what the audience award might be?
I don't have a guess. Although I would say possibly. I don't know.
Yeah,
are
always.
I think maybe Eighth Grade, which is another movie I really liked. Very funny, very awkward. And in some places, a little bit disturbing look at an eighth grade girl trying to navigate that very difficult part of life.
And I can't imagine the torture out there today with social media and all of that component. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be your most awkward self and then have it recorded for posterity.
In the social media age, bullying isn't like actively saying bad things about you. It's looking at your phone and not acknowledging the other's existence, which is like in its own way is as harsh and as brutal.
It really was wonderfully done, and her relationship with her dad was very funny.
I definitely related to the father character in that one. Yeah, played by Josh Hamilton.
Yeah. So. Any guess from you as to an audience award?
You know, I really don't have a clue, and I'm really curious about the difference this year between, you know, the audience award and the festival favorite, which is something new.
It just opened
everything up. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Sean, always good to spend some time with you. Thank you for being here again and enjoy your 3 movies today.
Thank you.
It's Sean Mean, the critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to the Sundance Reel on KPCW. Thank you.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Support for KPCW comes from the Crandall family, owners of the New Park Amphitheater, site of the New Park Concert Series, and numerous other community events.
It's 9:36. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the Sundance Reel. In the studio with me, of course, my co-host, Barb Bretz. Well, back in 1983, complete strangers accidentally discover they are identical triplets who were separated by birth, at birth. Director Tim Wardle telling the story of their joyous reunion, but also discovering a secret that goes beyond their own lives. Three Identical Strangers is one of the films in this year's U.S. documentary competition. The director, Tim Wardle, joins us now in the studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Leslie.
Yeah, so how did it come about for you to make this film? I mean, did you know one of the kids? Or
A brilliant young producer called Grace Hughes Hallett brought it into the company I work for, Raw, and I was working in development. My job was to develop up ideas for the company to make, and as soon as I saw it, I knew that it was the single best documentary idea I'd ever seen. And I was like, I have to make this film.
And I can't remember, Tim, if I saw you in an interview or if they mentioned it at the Salt Lake Tribune preview night, that other docs have attempted to be made before and they just weren't successful. Why is that?
Yeah, so that was, you know, my first reaction when I saw this story, other than say this is brilliant, was to say, why hasn't this been done before? And very quickly we found out that people had tried to do it before. Three major U.S. networks had attempted, two in 1980, in the 80s, and one in the 1990s. And every time the documentary has been shut down by kind of senior management at the networks. We spoke to one Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in New York who had been a producer on this documentary in the 90s that had told most of the story that we're telling in this one. And it got the whole film complete, ready to go out on television. The last minute, orders from on high, no, we're not putting it out. And he never found out why that was. So there are a lot of kind of conspiracy theories about why this story has never been told in the past.
Well, and just the fact that we're talking about conspiracy theories, you know that the film goes much deeper than just these three boys being reunited. And I don't know how much spoiler alert we're going to go into in discussion, so I'll let you take it from there.
It's really tricky. You're right. It's really tricky to talk about this film without giving too much away. And I really like people coming to see it as cold as possible. I mean, what I will say is that the initial reunion of the three boys is initially joyous, but it takes darker twists as the story goes on. And the film explores much bigger themes of kind of free will, destiny, family. There's something for everyone in there.
Yeah. So was it, I mean, did you know about this, what we're not talking about? Or did you discover it during the filming?
We knew some of it, but not all. And you know, there's a lot that happened while we were filming that we couldn't predict. We didn't know where it was going to end when we started. We knew about half the story, but we didn't know the ending.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was news to me. I don't remember hearing this story, but apparently they were very notorious.
They were popular, very popular. They made every talk show, you know, every newspaper, every media print article. They were like the darlings of what, the late 80s?
No, well, it was early 80s, actually.
Early
80s. It was 1980, actually, that they got reunited. And they went on every show, Donahue, all the big talk shows. They're in Desperately Seeking Susan. They recorded an episode of Cheers. They were out in Hollywood. They were Annie Leibovitz was taking them to Studio 54. I mean, they were partying hard, and that's part of the fun of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can you tell us how it happened, though, that they find each other, or does that wreck the...
No, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's the easy part.
The easy part. No, the story of how they met is extraordinary, because they met by coincidence. As you say, they were split up at birth and adopted by three separate families who had no idea that their son had brothers. And what happens is one of the boys, Bobby, in 1980, goes to this small college in upstate New York, turns up the first day. He's a freshman. He doesn't know anyone. And he's walking through the college, and everyone comes up to him saying, "Hey, man, good to see you." Girls are coming up to him, kissing him. Guys are hugging him. He doesn't know what's going on. He's never been there before. And eventually someone comes up to him and says, "Were you adopted?" And he says, "Yes." And this guy says to him, I think you've got a twin brother. And so him and his twin brother Eddie, who was at the same college the year before, coincidentally, they are reunited. And everyone celebrates and thinks, wow, long lost twins separated at birth. Amazing reunion story. It's in all the papers. The very next day, they get a call from someone who says, I'm reading about you guys in the paper and I look just like you. I think I'm the third. I think we're triplets.
And that's the tip of the iceberg.
That is just
that
the setup.
In itself is a story. But
yeah, that's just the setup.
Yeah. So have they seen the film?
Yeah. Two of the triplets were out in Park City for the premiere and had a great time out here. You know, they still live in New York. They love it. And I think the reaction to them has been extraordinary. You know, that's been one of the best things for me is they have quite a difficult relationship these days. But they said the experience of coming out to Park City and showing it to people has actually brought them together, which has been lovely.
Yeah. So what do we know about their parents, or is that part of the...
It is part of the story. I mean, they do discover their birth mother in the story. I don't want to give too much away, but she's part of the story.
Yeah. So if we don't see it in the next 3 days, I mean, will we be able to see it somewhere?
Well, so the film just got bought a couple of days ago, which was extraordinary and far beyond what we hoped for. So it is going to be in theaters in the US. I'm not sure when yet. That's down to distributors. But there's a screening on Saturday tomorrow at 2:30 at the Prospector in Park City. So I think there's still tickets available for that. But beyond that, yeah, it'll be in theaters sometime this year.
Yeah. So what else have you worked on before jumping into this?
I've done quite a few documentaries for TV in the UK, but this is my first kind of theatrical documentary. So this whole experience has been pretty wild. First time in Utah, first time in Park City, first time at Sundance.
I have to ask you about your first screening. I was not at the first screening. I saw it at the Ray, I don't believe. No, it wasn't the first screening.
The Ray was the first screening.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, the audience reaction, because, I mean, I know there wasn't a dry eye anywhere around where I was sitting. And to see an audience that moved had to be pretty special.
It was amazing. And you know, we were working on this right up until the time we came out here. And we didn't test screen it or anything like that. So audiences who are seeing it out here, seeing it fresh for the first time and seeing people laugh, seeing people cry, it just been absolutely extraordinary and far beyond what we were hoping for. And actually, you know, there was a screening in Redstone 2 days ago and there was a massive queue outside and people couldn't get in. And then up at the resort, Sundance Resort, yesterday, again, they said it was the busiest screening they've had so far. So it's been incredible.
Well, once I saw it, I've been helping with that buzz because everyone I talk
Thank
to,
you.
That's top of my list.
Thank you. It's just a great human story. You know, someone, one of the programmers at Sundance said it's a documentary for people who don't like documentaries. And you could take that as an insult, but I think actually it's a real compliment. You know, it's such an entertaining and wild story that I'd encourage anyone to come and see it.
I definitely would.
And
too.
What about their parents? I mean, they're people, you know, the parents who raised them.
Absolutely. Well, so that is a huge part of the story. You know, at its heart, you know, this film is asking questions of nature versus nurture. You know, does our biology define who we are, or does our environment? You know, so that the relationship between the boys and their adoptive families is kind of crucial to the narrative of the story.
And there are some of the parents interviewed during the doc as well.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we look forward to it. Congratulations on the sale of it. That's awesome.
Thank you so much.
Good.
Thank
well, thanks
you.
Thanks for spending time with us. Again, that's the director of the U.S. documentary film, Three Identical Strangers. You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
And welcome to the Sundance Reel. I'm Leslie Thatcher, along with my co-host, Barb Bretz. Well, a 10-year-old kid, Flynn McGarry, transforms his living room into a supper club, and his culinary skill catapults him into fame. The film Chef Flynn, one of the documentaries premiering at this year's festival. Joining me now in the studio, I have director Cameron Yates, along with producer Laura Cox. And good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so just a little brief understanding of the film. This young kid, Flynn, learns how to cook. Apparently, he gets bored with his mom's cooking. And he ends up accomplishing more than most chefs do in an entire lifetime by the time he's 16. I mean, how did you guys find out about Flynn? I mean, you heard about his food, or I mean, what was it?
Yeah, I mean, my father, of all people, handed me this New Yorker Talk of the Town piece, a little short piece called Prodigy. And it talked about this kid who'd opened up this restaurant in his mother's living room in Studio City, California, and was, you know, sneaking into his neighbor's backyards and foraging from his backyards. And it talked a little bit about his family. So I was curious to know more, and I contacted them, and we met up in L.A. And when I tried his food, I realized that he was definitely the real deal, and I wanted to make a film about him. But
so at this point, he was about 15 or so?
When I first met him, he was about 13.
Yeah, oh, wow.
13, yes.
So. And so he was still doing stuff in the living room?
He was still doing stuff in the living room, but he'd also been invited to do some pop-up dinners in different restaurants around Los Angeles as well. And he'd already actually staged at 11 Madison Park in New York and Alinea in Chicago. And so he was already kind of, you know, on the rise. But I realized, the exciting thing, though, too, is that I realized that his mother had this wealth of archival footage that she'd been shooting for so many years.
I was going to ask you about that. Was she a filmmaker? And was that her original intent to make a film?
Well, that's a great question. She is a filmmaker. Her short played at Sundance, actually.
Oh.
33 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. And with that footage? I mean, with him?
No. So that's the thing. Her films are more fiction, narrative-based. She's a writer. She like the creative side. And so while she was filming Flynn, she wasn't thinking documentary. And even when she was filming him in the way that I don't think he appreciated, she was kind of fantasizing it a little bit.
Yeah. So tell me, what did you learn about culinary skill here from this kid? I mean, is it all about presentation? Is it just somebody who's just got innate knowledge of what goes together?
Laura's actually been a chef.
Ah,
that's
okay.
A secret. You might not know.
That's what appealed. I think it really is his balance, what I've learned. I love cooking, but I'm a messy family style cook.
You're not into the presentation
thing? It does not look pretty. And I was sort of, I mean, Cameron was so savvy. He brought me and the editor to Flynn's pop-up to get before we got involved. And it was just six people. And watching him cook and watching the timing and the balance and the flavor balance and just thinking about the whole picture was really exciting to me. And seeing how much he loved what he was doing. It's fun to watch someone doing
something passionate.
They love.
Yeah.
And for me as well, I mean, the taste was obviously there, but the artistry of it, and actually every dish of his really looked like a painting or a piece of art, and I was really excited by that, but documenting that as well. But I definitely learned along the way, but I have a long way to go as well. Yeah.
And Flynn was here, and in one of his Q&As, he said something I thought was really beautiful about, I mean, he's a very cute kid, but he's kind of shy and nerdy because there's this one thing he's really passionate about, but he said that, you know, his cooking and the way he cooks is how he expresses himself, and I just thought that was so sweet. Like,
well, and he does mention in the movie too, I'm sure a lot of people, if they say anything negative, it's, you know, did he give up his childhood? And he says, well, he had 10 years and he thought that was enough. And, you know, that brought a bit of a giggle. Is it enough? But, you know, what's your view on that whole scene?
I'm honestly kind of dazzled by him. I don't understand that sort of, like real confidence that what he's doing is what he wants to be doing. I wish I had a little bit more of that. Like I always respond to that with people, and I think that's just. I think he honestly means he's really craving being seen as a chef, not a kid chef.
Yeah, and for me, what interests me, I always was curious about this sort of hierarchy in the kitchen and having to work yourself up the ladder and work many years, and he definitely just jumped over that. I mean, he staged in kitchens, but he started creating his dishes at such an early age that he's kind of skipped a bit. So,
and in that world, is that possible? Will that be okay?
That makes people mad.
I mean, you know, understandably, someone who's been working the line for 15 years, it's a rough job. And I think there's a little bit of bitterness.
So has he gone on to culinary school? I mean, is that what he's doing? Or he doesn't need to?
He studied in Copenhagen, and he traveled to Italy. It seems to me he's more the apprentice side of learning, not going to schools, but he's always finding a chef he can work under, going to 11 Madison Park.
But he's still so young. I mean, has he done all that on his own or accompanied by mom?
At a certain point, I think about 15, 16, he left home from L.A. and went to Europe for a few months and was on his own. And it's interesting now because, you know, he is opening his first restaurant in New York, and he can't actually – his sister is the owner because she's over 21. He's 19. So she, in order to have wine and beer, like, he has to actually have a sister the owner, but he's doing all the business aspects too, so it's really a huge undertaking.
What's the name of the restaurant?
It's actually called Jem.
Jem, which is Meg's name backwards, was her idea.
His
mom's
name.
Ah, okay. In terms of, I mean, did he cook for you as well? I mean, did you guys have some meals together? And tell me about those.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I've definitely had a few tasting menus in different places, whether in New York and L.A. But I've also had some home-cooked meals at his house. I mean, when he's at home, he says his favorite thing to do is just like a carbonara, a very simple pasta or grilled cheese. Because he says as a chef, he's constantly trying food all night, all day long, and eating the scraps of what he's been making that, you know, when he gets home, he just wants to make something very simple.
But, yeah.
And he's still growing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, grilled cheese was something I thought, and I was thinking mac and cheese as well. But I mean, you could do so much with it, right?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
So what happens with the film from here?
We've been invited to be the opening night of the Berlin Culinary Cinema.
Awesome.
Which is really exciting.
And he cooks for everyone after the screening, which is such a relief because everyone's always asking to eat his food so we can finally have everything all together.
That is great.
Yeah.
So do you, I mean, you follow it to Berlin and
we're going to do a festival circuit. We're hoping to sell. Yeah. You know, we were just so thrilled to be here that we're kind of still reeling. And
yeah, and what was his reaction? I mean, being here again, what is he about?
He's 19 now.
And his mother and sister also came as well. So we were so happy to have the whole family here. They've been to, you know, she's been to Sundance years ago. He came a few years ago to do a cooking demonstration for the festival. I think they were blown away by the audience reaction, I think. Especially in Salt Lake, too.
Yeah. Salt Lake. Yeah. The crowds have been amazing. We weren't really expecting how many people would want selfies with Flynn. It's been a little bit of a surprise. But we also had a group dance party the night before our premiere, so that.
Yeah. So do you have more screenings then? I mean,
No.
Our last screening was yesterday evening at the Ray in Park City. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this just smacks of Park City, a Park City screening. So hopefully it does get somewhere that it's something that could be shown here locally. We're foodies here. I mean, you've seen the number of restaurants, right?
Oh my gosh,
this is a special place.
Yeah. Well, the best of luck to you. Thanks for spending some time with us this morning.
Thanks for watching the film, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Well, we've got a few more minutes here, and bringing back Barb Bretz, again, my co-host here for the last couple of days, so thanks for that. Let's just kind of finish up talking about some of what you've heard, because that's one of your favorite parts, of course, is the Q&As.
It is, you know, and I think my most powerful one that I've been to followed the movie called The Tale, and there are several movies that are here as dramas, but they are really true stories based on true stories. They could almost be documentaries, but they're done as dramas, and The Tale is one of those. It was difficult to sit through just because of the subject material, but the director, and I'm forgetting her name at the moment, had an experience when she was a very young girl that she had sort of denied or justified through her life. And when, as an adult, it was brought again to her attention and she started delving into it, she realized that she had been lured into a very inappropriate sexual relationship when she was 13. And so at the Q&A, Jason Ritter, who's so lovable in every character he ever plays, was cast as the perpetrator. And they did have a disclaimer at the end of the film that no minors had been used in any of the filming. So they explained how they did that with this young 11-year-old actress, that she wasn't even laying in a bed. She was up against what they call a vertical bed, and they would give her cues, like pretend like you've been stung by a bee, and she would make these facial expressions, which were then edited into the final scene. Jason, when he was recording, had an adult body double to kind of help with the realism. But I'm sure, as in so many of these cases, the cast had probably just viewed the premiere for the first time along with everybody else. And for Jason Ritter to sit there on that huge screen with 1,500 people and watch himself be a predator with this young girl had to be the most awful experience of his life. And when he was called up to the stage for the Q&A, he really just almost could not speak. And when he tried to address, you know, how they did the filming, he really had to walk away from the microphone. I mean, he was that moved. And Laura Dern plays the adult version of this young girl who's flashing back and trying to deal with it. And Ellen Burstyn plays her mother. And she was really excellent in the role, because something like this just brings up so many guilt feelings and family dynamics and why didn't I know, and you know, all of those things. And I'm sure, having had her own Me Too moments and things like that, she was so passionate about the conversation that a film like this is starting. And so that was probably the most powerful Q&A that I went to. Also the Q&A for What They Had, which touches a little bit on Alzheimer's, but it's definitely not the theme. The theme is really family dynamics and how a family rallies around or not, and you know, deals with some of these issues that a lot of us can relate to very much. But Hilary Swank plays the daughter, and she's so passionate about the issues. And Blythe Danner plays the mother. And of course, the last couple of years, she's had these really incredible roles here at Sundance as a leading lady, which she never got in her prime. But now in her 70s, she's really excelling and bringing so much to these roles. It was really awesome.
Yeah. What else is on your list of to see?
Oh, to see. I'm so excited I finally get to see Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary about Mr. Rogers done by Morgan Neville, who's one of our favorite doc directors. So I'm seeing that today. I'm going to see the Jane Fonda documentary. And tomorrow, Believer, which we were talking about earlier today. I'm really excited to see that. And then I'm going to film church on Sunday.
Right.
I just found out about it this year. It's been going on right under my nose for a couple of years, and I can't wait to go.
Okay. And again, it's really interesting to hear you now and then as these films kind of come to either the Park City Film Series or mm-hmm. theatrical release. We'll hear some of you with the reviews as well. Mm-hmm. So again, hey, thanks, Barb.
It's been great.
Well, a big thank you to our exclusive sponsor of the Sundance Reel this year, Sandra Lee Incorporated, presenting the documentary Prescription, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey with Sandra Lee. Big thank you also to the producer of the Sundance Reel, Beth Fratkin, for knocking it out of the park this year. And all of our co-hosts, of course, including our Friday film reviewers, Barb Bretz, Linda Jager, and Mark Harrington. Also joining us this year, Katie Wang, Katie Eldridge, Stacey Domalski, and David Darcy. You can find all of the conversations over the last 8 days online at kpcw.org. Next week, of course, we'll be back to regular programming. So, again, stay tuned. We've got Emily coming up with music. This is KPCW, listener-supported public radio, KPCW Park City. It's 10 o'clock, time for news.